Hi, friends. My name is Chris Tripolino, and it's my privilege to welcome you to the Fabric Podcast. We're calling our current conversation Better Than Better, and in this episode, Greg Meyer helps us wonder what could be better than better in the context of conflict. First, Kenny Escher will join me in creating a classic situation for conflict: roommates. One has just started a video call after the other has left to hang out with a friend.
Hey.
Sorry, we were just going to start that movie. What's up?
Don't worry, I'll be quick. You know you're wrong, right?
About what?
Yeah, you know, about how you put the toilet paper on the holder in the bathroom.
Oh my gosh. So you left like two sheets on the roll and didn't change it. And so I, after using those two sheets, changed the roll like you're supposed to when it's gone.
You put it on wrong.
I put it on like you're supposed to put it on.
You put it on with the end going away from the wall.
Yeah, like I said, like you're supposed to.
No, that's wasteful. People pull on that way and a whole bunch comes off and they use way more than they should. It's supposed to come off the back of the roll towards the wall. That controls the speed of the roll so you don't get more than you need.
So you've really thought about this a lot.
It's not just driving a hybrid instead of an SUV that matters and is going to save the planet. Toilet paper matters.
Yeah, but I mean, I grew up having it come over the top towards you, which seems to make a lot more sense. I mean, you don't spend all your time trying to find the end of the toilet paper jammed up against the wall, spinning it around and whatever. Besides, that's what they do in hotels.
Do you think I think that matters?
Apparently not.
Listen, we're new roommates. I like you. We're going to have fun, but you need to put the toilet paper on the right way.
I didn't know you were a toilet paper Nazi.
And I didn't know you were a toilet paper idiot.
Okay, so somehow I don't think this argument is helping.
Well, you're right about that. All you have to do is put the toilet paper on correctly.
So I can just say yes.
Hey, but great. Problem solved.
But I think that I'm going to end up thinking bad things about you every time I look at toilet paper for the rest of my life. And that doesn't feel good.
You know what? You'll get over it.
I don't want to get over it. I would rather we just figured out a different way to solve this.
Nice idea, but two problems. There are only two ways of putting the toilet paper on the toilet paper roll. Over the front or over the back. There isn't a third kumbaya way.
And the second problem?
That your way is wrong, man.
Oh my gosh. So somehow I'm feeling worse now. I think there's a bigger problem here than which way the toilet paper comes off the roll.
And what would that be?
Well, basically like the way we're handling this problem. I can't believe it, but this is like making me want to move out, which is stupid. I mean, like when my friends would ask me why I moved out, I can't tell them that it's because I had an argument with my roommate about which way to put the toilet paper on the roll.
So what are we going to do?
Hold on. I mean, that's the question, right? Like, it's not really about which way, you know, like what right or wrong way. It's more like what we are going to do. So here, okay, check these out. Here's a toilet paper dispenser that can solve the problem. It's the back of a dog that you attach to the wall, and then the toilet paper comes out horizontally from the dog's, you know what. And then there's no over the front or over the back or whatever.
Yeah, hey, you know, I like this one. It's a statue of an old English waiter standing with one hand held out, and he's giving you the finger. And that's what you put the toilet paper
oh
on.
Oh my gosh.
I love that.
Okay, so since the roll sits on its side, then we don't have to fight about which way is better.
Plus, he's giving you the finger.
Which I guess is better than us flipping each other off.
Yeah, it's really funny. And it is better than us flipping each other off.
Yeah, you're right.
Of course, I'm right.
Okay, can I get back to my movie then?
Enjoy.
All right.
Phew, crisis averted. Good job, guys. This is Greg Meyer, and welcome to the end of February 2022. Next month is the second anniversary of the beginning of all those COVID-19 lockdowns across our country. You know, that disease that was dramatized and co-opted by some to cripple our economy and force behaviors upon everyone to the detriment of their personal liberties, or otherwise thought of as a disaster mismanaged by leaders who ignored medical science, refused to enforce social responsibility, and were culpable for the deaths of hundreds of thousands of people. And during that maelstrom, we were also moving towards an election in which the president who was getting our nation back on track was being smeared and lied about, or an election to replace a president who was inept, dangerous, and narcissistic. In the meantime, George Floyd was murdered by police in Minneapolis and a much overdue period of racial reckoning began. Or police officers who risked their lives every day were scapegoated for doing their job in a difficult situation, all for some socialist agenda that is undermining safety for our whole nation. Then January 6th in Washington, D.C., when a group of freedom patriots had the guts to stand up for what they knew was right and good for all, even at risk to themselves. Or a violent insurrection that threatened to topple our democracy was encouraged, maybe orchestrated, by the outgoing president. Wow, if I did my job well there, I just separated every one of you into one of two camps and reinforced feelings of anger, disrespect, maybe disbelief in you for those in the other. We are in our second week of better than better. What's better than better? Good question. If it were obvious, we wouldn't have to spend 4 weeks trying to understand it. Better, all by itself, is something we all know. Better is, well, better. And who doesn't like better? I do. But better has a dark side. Unless we control our drive for better, it becomes a conveyor belt of constant improvement that we just can't get off of. We lose track of its purpose and the chase is on. Better isn't about making us more whole. It turns into simply more, bigger, shinier, faster, just because. It can get tyrannical. It's a proverbial, what have you done for me today? Yesterday's better isn't good enough for today. Better will eat you for lunch and ask for dinner. Last week, Melissa Locke defined this slippery slope of better as a drive for constant progress towards a prescribed norm or ideal. It's worth noting that that prescribed norm or ideal is often not one that you established or even consciously agreed to. It's just out there, and it keeps slipping further away the harder you work for it. So then, if that's what better is, what's better than better? Well, something that escapes that unending drive towards something you'll never achieve, I suppose. Something that doesn't feel like it's always judging you for not being good enough. Something that responds to what actually makes sense for your life and your situation and doesn't leave you feeling empty in pursuing it. And perhaps most importantly, it's a kind of better that reflects how growth happens. That's the definition Melissa and I see as fitting better than better. Growth. And growth goes through all kinds of stages and heads in all sorts of directions in order to develop. They aren't all up the stairway, each step higher than the last. No, better than better weaves around. It goes forward and backward, has bumps and bruises, failures and successes, all in the hopes of growing, of becoming more whole. Like the better that you can ever achieve, this better than better is also never over. But instead of making you feel not enough, it reassures you that who and where you are is okay. In fact, more than okay. Everything about your life and history is fodder for what's next. You're pregnant with possibility. And nothing is wasted of both your best and your worst. You may not be part of it all. You may have regrets. Of course, you don't have to pretend. Just own it. Let it be out in the open where you can use what you've learned through it, not hidden away in the basement of your soul where it weighs you down and tries to sink you. So better than better, it's better than better. Yeah, well, Today, I want to explore what I feel is one of the most important issues in our lives and in our society today. Figuring out what better than better is regarding it is crucial to our futures. I want to talk about better than better conflict. Let's start with what just better conflict might be. First, I guess that would be no conflict, right? But that's not going to happen. In fact, no matter how much you might not like conflict, I don't think we want to get rid of all of it. It doesn't have to get ugly, but there are things to work out that will have compelling and competing and confusing demands. So better conflict isn't just no conflict. The next alternative seems to be conflict in which everything is settled like I would like it to be. Translation, conflict that I win. Well, that sounds great, but you don't need me to point out the problem with that. If I win, then you lose, right? And I bet you don't think that's better. So you're probably going to muster your forces, accumulate your leverage and power until you can tip the balance so that you win and I lose. Do I hear rumblings of partisan politics or marital discontent here? Yeah, probably so. Okay, so winning isn't better than better conflict either. So what is it? To figure that out, we need to understand conflict a little bit better, or a little better than better, or you know what I mean. Anyway, conflict is a tension or friction we feel when we disagree or we see things differently from someone else. We're at odds with them. Conflict can be heated and emotional. It's always stressful and pretty much always unpleasant. I would encourage you right now to pause this podcast for about 30 seconds and call to mind a conflict that you are in right now. Yes, you do have one. We all do. And give words to the thoughts and the feelings that rise up within you as you consider that conflict. Now, all those unpleasant and frightening characteristics of conflict don't mean that conflict is bad. Conflict that we keep out in the open and deal with by engaging the other parties involved is part of solving difficult problems. It's preserving our dignity. It's standing up for people who need our voice. That kind of conflict helps us grow. Amanda Ripley, a journalist and author of an excellent book called High Conflict, calls this good or healthy conflict. But the edge of healthy conflict is easy to slip over. And when we do, we end up in something Ripley calls high conflict. High conflict isn't the place where we work things out, where we grow. It's a place we get stuck because we're seeking to win at all costs, which we talked about earlier is something that doesn't really happen. And the at all costs part of high conflict takes us even a step further from good conflict. When we realize we won't win, that the other side is not going to see our side no matter how clearly we lay it all out for them, we do something else intrinsic to high conflict. This is the deadly step. We dehumanize them. The other person or group isn't just the people who see it differently from us. They become our opponents. Our two roommates that we overheard the conversation of a bit earlier started the descent into high conflict over toilet paper. You could feel them losing all the joy they had as friends and starting to see themselves as enemies. Toilet paper Nazis are idiots. Laughable, I know, but yeah, uncomfortably not. We've all experienced worse over less. You may have experienced slipping over that same edge when I started this podcast by talking about some of the divisive issues we're all stuck in from a perspective that matches you and from a perspective that matches them. Yeah, that's the next step. High conflict turns me and you into us and them. The people not in your camp aren't individuals with their own stories and reasons behind their ideas and opinions anymore. They are just one of them, representatives of a group. Names and faces are less important than the stereotypes that take their place. And you know people like them, they don't think. They have no good motives, they're mistaken, ill-willed, selfish, uneducated, whatever. It's no use talking to them. They not only don't get it, they don't want to get it. That's another thing we do to defend our position. We turn it into a battle of right and wrong, not of my perspective and your perspective. The fact that those other people can't realize they are wrong and refuse to see the logic, the truth of your position, the right position, makes it even easier to depersonalize and dismiss them. It justifies name calling, even violence. And despite your professed desire to influence them, This attitude actually further alienates them, making them less interested in your side of the story. And as you turn your back to them, you are retreating to people like you. Separation is now complete. High conflict is a hold of the situation, not you. It's quite possible that Hillary Clinton lost the election in 2016 when she referred to half of Donald Trump's supporters as a basket of deplorables. High conflict was certainly well in control of the election before that, but while that label may have galvanized her supporters and probably felt really good to say, it was the signal to those not in her camp that they needed to decide there was no redeeming value in her or her ideas. That includes those in the middle who may have been trying to keep out of the mire, but who felt rejected by that disdainful dismissal. In the middle of this battle over right and wrong, we also tend to lose sight of what the conflict was about in the first place. Often, in fact, we don't just lose sight of it. We never knew what it was about in the first place anyway. I mean, do you think either of those roommates really cared that much about the toilet paper? Or did it actually represent something that they grew up with and they have trouble letting go of? Or a sense of control over something in a world that otherwise feels so out of control? Or something more like that? Do you think the couple whose constant fights over money really has values that are that different? Well, maybe, but more likely they have very different ways of managing money and probably poor communication skills in an area that is full of the landmines of individual difference and baggage. Speaking of communication skills, that's the next thing that goes out the window. There is dehumanization, us and theming, right and wronging, not knowing the real center of the conflict, and then listening, or should I say, not listening. When we do listen to the other side, it's often only to confirm what we already believe to be true. It isn't to the story of the lives of our opponents, but to some fictional straw horse of a them. We think we're open, and we're not. Now, we put all those ingredients together, and we have created a hall of mirrors that we can't see out of, and a pit of quicksand we can't get out of. And while we do this in order to fix something, the result of high conflict invariably hurts both sides. Fighting alone with no hope of resolution should be enough, but fighting against someone else rather than for something important takes an even greater cost. And you want to know something more? While we hate the feeling of being stuck in the high conflict world, there is some self-righteous side in each and every one of us that secretly loves it and doesn't want to let it go. Okay, now that's a lot. I hope you don't take what I said to mean that everyone is half right, that no side is ever closer to what is fair or just, or that neither side is more responsible for the heightening of the conflict. Of course, those are all often true. The point is that when we allow the conflict, the tension, disagreement, difference of opinion, good conflict, when we allow that to turn into high conflict, there are no longer any winners, only losers. It doesn't matter that you're on the higher moral ground or that you are ahead of the others, because you are stuck. Now, high conflict is toxic stuff. No one among us is immune from it. I know I find myself pulled into it socially, politically, and even in my own home. Some of the issues I'm still stuck in and probably don't see it. Some I haven't found the will to extract myself from, or I don't know how. Others I know I spent far too long in before I got out, and I can see the hurt and the division that I was part of creating. The reason we're talking high conflict is so that we can, one, get an image of better than better conflict in our hearts and minds, and two, that we can become aware of the traps that lure us in and try to keep us there. And then hopefully we can also develop strategies that make it less likely to get stuck there in the first place. My hope is that we can make our inevitable conflicts serve us rather than destroy us. Before we go there, however, there's one more note I must make, and it's a personal request. High conflict pulls people in, and the more people who get sucked in, the stronger the pull and the harder it is for anyone to ever escape. My request is this: choose to be a force outside the opposing sides, not in one of them. Don't be part of an us or them. Keep others from being pulled in and reverse the pull on those already in. Be eyes and a path that cannot be found from within. Be an advocate for growth, unity, empathy, understanding, and hope, and do that by practicing them yourself. Now, this path out of high conflict is not a romantic one. Conflict is real. The causes of it are often things that really matter. They're issues of love and justice, freedom, opportunity, and health. The path forward through them is almost always murky, and the best path possible doesn't always work. Sometimes injustice still wins, and love loses. Freedom is sacrificed. 2,000 years ago, Jesus came, as John's Gospel says, full of grace and truth. Who wouldn't love that? Yet even as an infant, when he was presented in the temple, the tradition notes that a prophet, Simeon, who represents those who could see deeper into the fabric the most, gave this premonition that this child is destined for the falling and the rising of many in Israel, and to be a sign that will be opposed. What he's saying is that people are going to be divided over him. Some aren't going to want the love that he offers. At age 12, when he returns to the temple for Passover, he's storied to have stayed behind in the temple, listening to the scholars, the Jewish authorities, and asking them questions, and we're told that all who heard him were amazed at his understanding and his answers. The passage concludes with these words, "And Jesus increased in wisdom and in years, and in favor with God and people." He started out as a big hit. What wasn't to like about a kid like that? Now, I'm not telling you this, expecting you to believe that those are all accurate quotes or historically true. That's not the point. The point is that the tradition wants us to realize that this grace and truth that Jesus carried into the world was welcome, but it didn't stay that way. You know the story. As a man with a gift to share, he gave it freely, asking little in return. And people were interested. The Jesus bandwagon swelled, but Jesus always seemed to be trying to undermine it. He repeatedly told people not to tell others what he had done. He didn't want to create a bandwagon or get a headline. He wanted to touch people's lives. He wanted others to know that they could do that too. It wasn't just him. But those same authorities who were amazed at him before were now jealous. They feared their power and their position eroding, so they countered him. When he didn't comply or their muscle didn't quell the storm to come, they decided to oppose him no matter what, at all costs. Finding technicalities and hypocritical grounds for denouncing him, losing track of what mattered or of why most of them had become rabbis, priests, scribes, Pharisees, or whatever in the first place. Yep, high conflict had begun. But Jesus wouldn't take it up. Yes, he lost his temper with them. He called the authorities names, I think. Broods of vipers would qualify as name-calling. Probably accurate, of course, but name-calling nonetheless. You know, but he never mustered his forces, even when asked to. He sought understanding, love, healing, whenever and wherever he could. He continued to center himself in the midst of those who opposed him so that there could be discussion. Now, I would love to narrate much of Jesus' life in terms of someone who knew that high conflict was not aligned with God, that it would unravel the fabric of existence instead of weaving it. But let me jump to the end of Jesus' story. The night before his crucifixion, when he went to a garden called Gethsemane, knowing that the conflict had reached its boiling point and would not, could not be reversed, not for him anyway. There, one of his own, Judas, gave up on Jesus because he wouldn't create an us that would fight the them. So Judas betrayed him. And he did it with a kiss to show the soldiers which was Jesus. A gift of love twisted into an act of violence. One of Jesus' other disciples then pulls out a sword, and Jesus is recorded as saying something that speaks exactly to what we are talking about. He says, "Put your sword back into its place, for all who take the sword will perish by the sword." To phrase that in terms of today's conversation, Jesus was saying, those who divide to accomplish something will die through the dividing. We are part of one another. There is no true apart from-ness. Then finally, on the cross, rather than joining the high conflict by mounting his own attack or even speaking in his own defense, he simply says, "Forgive them, for they do not know what they are doing." That kind of forgiveness is no letting someone off the hook. It's much deeper than that. It is a prayer that God would reach deep within the hearts of those who oppose him to help them see what they could not see, to do what they could not do. Among the many things that represented, one of them was to save them, to save us from the vortex of high conflict. This was not Jesus giving up, nor was it him thinking that this all was his part in settling some cosmic equation that he knew about all along, because there is no such equation as that, and he knew it. The universe isn't a game. It is a great unfinished possibility, forever evolving. And Jesus, standing proudly for what he believed in, even when it was not respected or recognized, was perhaps his way of making sure that the universe evolved in a way that leaned toward love, toward hope and understanding. He wanted his life to pull people away from that which destroys us, not towards it. Is that story true? Is that not true? I don't know. But here I am, 2,000 years later, remembering it. Jesus did it. Maybe I can too. Maybe you can too. So how? That's the question. Like I said, there's no such thing as high conflict proofing yourself, but there are practices that make it happen less often and that can help you realize it when you do go there and to interrupt it and to learn to find your way out. They're largely the reversing of the characteristics of high conflict that we mentioned before, and they are things that we talk about often as a community. And the first is this: to remember your opponent is a person, a human being. Like you, they are doing what they're doing, thinking what they're thinking, for a reason. I'm sure there are some people out in the world who are purely evil, but that's rare. Something that isn't rare is the number of hurting people in the world. And guess what? You're one of them. Hurting people do strange things. I'll leave it at that. Now, you can judge them if you want, but be careful about throwing the first stone. Compassion might be a better idea. Folks, our world needs a lot more compassion and a lot less judgment. Can I get an amen on that? Okay, I'm not hearing you, but I'll assume you're saying it. Thanks. And by the way, recognizing that they are people doesn't mean agreeing with them, condoning their ideas or their actions. It doesn't even mean you have to like them. You do need to see them as human beings, though, and you need to treat them as such. Okay. Second, listen. Listen. Then when you've listened for a long time, listen some more. Not for an opportunity to counter their argument, not for a chance to break in, but for the person behind the pain, the anger, the stress, the worry, or fear. Seek to understand before you seek to be understood. In Amanda Ripley's book, she cites the mediator Gary Friedman's practice of looping. That is, listening and then repeating back the essence of what you heard so that the speaker can confirm whether or not you correctly understand. It sounds easy, and it's not. Even if you are a good listener, genuinely and accurately hearing another person's story is much more complicated than it sounds. Now, while you're listening to the other person, you might want to also take some time to listen to yourself, to your feelings and emotions, for your body's physical reaction to the discomfort of the conflict. Also, listen for telltale phrases like these coming out of your mouth or circling around inside your head. It's no use talking to them. Or, when will they see the light? Or, they don't care about anything but themselves. Or sentences that start with, people like that, or any us and them type language and categorization of people. These are signs that you may be slipping into the abyss yourself. Next, if you have listened deeply, you might be asked for your story. You might not be asked as well, and that's okay. But if you are, share your story, not your argument. You need to be a person in their eyes before you will ever be trusted enough to be listened to. Don't shortcut it. Jesus was a story, not an argument, and the world has never been the same. You want the other person to ask you more questions, not agree with you, because they won't drop their sword until they know you as a person. In Minnesota, LGBTQ rights hung in the balance for decades until LGBTQ families quit trying to convince and started telling their stories. And they invited others to notice similar stories in their own lives. When that happened, we experienced a huge shift in attitudes. We may know things in our heads, but we decide them in our hearts. Now, at this point, it makes sense for you to admit that you don't hold the whole answer to whatever your conflict is about. This doesn't mean that you don't hold any of the answer or that your position is full of holes. It simply means that this is a big world. Like COVID-19 is both a medical, social, and personal phenomenon, and to overlook any of those aspects and the prevention or handling of it is in vain. So there are dimensions and perspectives, other worlds of experience and value that you haven't considered yet and probably couldn't even be aware of. And those matter for others that are in your conflict. Even if you have the best solution, you still don't know how that solution is going to impact everyone else. This is where our practice of the better question comes in. Better than better is a better question exercise. When you have the humility to know that resolving any conflict is going to take the full sharing and participation of others, you start looking for questions that hold a bigger view of the conflict than you had before. When one of our roommates in our dialogue earlier decided that the question wasn't which way the toilet paper should go over the dispenser, but that it might be what kind of dispenser avoids the win-lose and, by the way, is also more fun, then they got somewhere. Practice looking for better questions to keep your conflict from turning into high conflict. Now there's one more, and it's this. Replace blame with collaboration. Now, if you're like me, when I get caught up in any kind of tension or problematic situation, what I really like to do is figure out whose fault it is. I like to assign blame. There's a time for figuring out who was at fault, of course, so something can be corrected. But that's not what we're usually doing in these situations. More likely, we're trying to strengthen our position by making someone else out as the problem causer. We're slipping into high conflict. Conflict, good conflict, can lead to collaboration and make room for the complexity of an issue. That is a path toward resolution, a better than better path. Conflict can also lead to blame, establishing right and wrong, and who is right and who is wrong. Isolation follows. Resolution, growth, they're nearly impossible from here. Find cues to remind yourself to ask, who can I work with on this, rather than who is to blame for this? Yeah, that's a lot. But all pretty simple, really. Remember, your opponent is a person. Listen to them and to yourself. Share your story, not your argument. Admit you don't know the whole story and replace blame with collaboration. You can do that. Not perfectly, not every time, but that's not what we're asking. Remember, Jesus had a bit of an attitude problem every once in a while too, and he turned out to be a pretty good guy. You're pretty good people too. The kind we could use more of, not on our side, but with us all, pulling us all together, not apart from each other. And what could be better than that? Better than better conflict. It will help you grow.
Thanks for listening. We hope this podcast sparks conversation in other parts of your life. If you're looking for meaningful connections, there's a Fabric group for you to try, whether you're in the Twin Cities or not. Tag @FabricMPLS with your wonderings on social media and find resources on our website, fabricmpls.com.